you can meet a person and then they're really into you and you start dating them, but in the back of your mind you're like, wait a minute, they're way more sexy than I am, way more intelligent than I am, like maybe they're more rich than I am, like more popular with all their friends or the life of the party, like why in the world would they be interested in me? There's no freaking reason why they would be.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out of the box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're talking about self-sabotage in relationships and in life.
Whoa.
So many of us can sour our lives in a variety of ways. Whether it manifests due to fear or lack of control, self-sabotage can keep us from getting what we really want in our relationships and in our lives. So today, we're going to talk about reasons why we self-sabotage, as well as how to combat them. And I really wanted the intro to this for me to just go, listen all y'all, it's a sabotage. Listen
oh,
all y'all, it's a sabotage. But I...
Who does that
Beastie
song?
Boys. Right?
Thing.
That song? The Beastie Boys?
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Just too young to be into the Beastie Boys. Like, just barely.
Yeah. Don't they, like, yell in that? And then it gets, like, kind of hard rock.
I mean, that's all of the Beastie Boys is kind of this, like...
Pretty much every single
yelling
Beastie Boys
hard
song
rock
is what
thing?
You described.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't really sing. It's like the three of them kind of rapping, yelling, yell rapping, yapping.
Well,
yapping.
I'm gonna stop here and just like sabotage your efforts to turn this into a podcast about the Beastie Boys and bring us back to the topic of self-sabotage.
Yeah.
Do we even know what that is?
Well, I can talk about what it is. I have a definition right here. Apparently, it is behavior that creates problems in our lives or interferes with long-standing goals. So that can mean like a lot of different things. If any of us have ever done something called procrastination, which
never.
I definitely
don't even know what you're talking about.
No. Yeah, no, that's definitely a way in which we self-sabotage. We have like a deadline coming up, something that we really need to get done. And we just decide to procrastinate, like put it off until the last minute. And then obviously it becomes a lot more difficult right at the end, but that's a form of self-sabotage. Also, even things like self-medicating, that can include alcohol, drugs, things like that. That can be construed as a form of self-sabotage. I know, like, medical marijuana, that's not necessarily, in my opinion, a part of self-sabotage. That's probably something that is a nice, like, way in which to cope and
deal with life. I think it depends how you use them. I think with all of this.
I guess you're probably
right. Yes, with all of it.
But if we're talking about something that really is interfering with your life in terms of like alcohol or drugs, and that can absolutely be construed as a form of self-sabotage.
Well, I think it's worth making the distinction here too, that this isn't self-sabotage isn't about like you're doing this thing and it's ruining your life. It's not even to that level, but like I'm doing this thing and it's making me not accomplish the things I want to accomplish, mm-hmm. or not have the relationships I want to have, or not have the friendships I want to have, right? That it's a little more subjective. It's not just like, oh, you're not even showing up to work. It doesn't have to be that extreme. It might just be like, I'm not getting the projects I want to get done. And instead, I'm like, I'll just have a drink or three so that I'm not so worried about it. And then I can just, you know. So there's that like fine line between like how much is just, you know, like, okay, I like this and I'm relaxing and I'm still achieving my goals, and how much is not that.
Yeah, how much is like I'm actually just putting it off indefinitely.
Right.
Well, any kind of substance, whether it's alcohol or illegal substances, like of course there's always going to be a line between, you know, what is just having fun or just relaxing or socializing versus what is like avoiding you know, using it as something that's avoiding dealing with something that's bigger in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Another way of self-sabotage is self-injury. This is a tough one for sure, but yeah, one of my dear, dear friends growing up, had trigotillomania, which was, like plucking out her own hairs. And that is definitely like a form of compulsive self-harm. There's a variety of other ones, obviously, but yeah, that, is a more extreme version, in my opinion, of like a self-sabotaging behavior. And then, yeah, addictions, which I think can go along with self-medicating in a variety of ways. But yeah,
But it could also be like an addiction to a behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or a substance. Any sort of behavior or substance can be an addiction. And then even just frequent interpersonal conflict. Like if you're a person that just tends to have a lot of conflict in their life, that can be a form of self-sabotage. If you're constantly like trying to find conflict, and you know, never really choosing to move past that, or it just kind of always comes towards you, then yeah, that can be a form of self-sabotage. And then also just even distorted thinking or beliefs. So poor self-worth, not being honest with yourself about what you actually want, what your goals are in your life, how you're achieving them, or if you're not. And then also heavy self-criticism. Things like that can definitely be a form of self-sabotage.
And I feel like a lot of these overlap.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, procrastination can be like linked with your decision to self-medicate, let's say, by, you know, just kind of like getting really drunk instead of doing what you need to do, which is also a form of self-injury, which can also lead to addiction or to frequent interpersonal conflict, and which maybe the base of it is like these distorted thinking or beliefs about your self-worth. Like, so it's all these things. Self-sabotage can definitely be this like holistic kind of force that can lead to many kinds of different behaviors.
Yeah.
So for this episode, for the first half of the episode, we're going to talk about some of the reasons why we self-sabotage, and kind of with the hope of getting some insights and seeing like which ones resonate for you. I know as we were preparing this, there were some of them that for me was like, yep, definitely do that one, and other ones less so. But even in putting together these categories, there was still a lot of like, well, you could argue that this one falls into the other category, that because there's so much overlap in all of this, and that your mind can try so many different ones of these strategies to try to keep itself comfortable or to stop from being afraid. So it is really interesting how much overlap there is, but we did end up landing on some categories that we felt like would help for at least kind of figuring out kind of which ones resonate the most with you and seem to show up the most in your life.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of these do tend to overlap, and I don't know, they can kind of like feed in and out of one another. Mm. So it is interesting to like look at it in that respect. So yeah, let's jump into it for sure.
Yeah, so we came up with 8. I'm going to start with our first one. So sometimes we can self-sabotage because of reasons that are deeply tied to our inherent sense of self-worth. So for instance, you know, sometimes we can prevent ourselves from taking action or like taking the first step toward a project that we want to do or a job that we want to apply for because there's a part of us that feels like maybe we don't deserve it. Maybe we don't feel worthy of this particular thing. And so we're not going to go after it in the first place. It can look a variety of ways. It could be something like maybe at work, you're always working overtime or you're taking on a bunch more tasks to try to make up for maybe feeling like you don't deserve the position that you have.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. In relationships, it can be, you know, you get this urge to kind of leave the relationship or to bail on the relationship once it's starting to get actually intimate or serious. And maybe that's linked to an idea of like, you don't feel like you're worthy of this person, or you don't feel like you're worthy of this particular relationship. I know this reminds me of, there was a study where they found that, in heterosexual couples where woman made significantly a higher income than the man did. So she was like, they were both working, but she was bringing in more money. They found surprisingly that actually still like the share of household work and childcare work still fell disproportionately to the woman, more so than in couples where their incomes were kind of relatively the same. They found that when it was relatively the same, it was closer that there was an equal division of labor.
Huh.
But with women who had significantly higher incomes, they actually took on more of the labor. And they theorize that the reason is that it's, you know, a lot of women have been so told that it's like they need to be the ones doing the caretaking, they need to be the ones doing the childcare, and based on a sense of like feeling guilty around having a busier or more, or quote unquote more successful job, that a lot of women felt pressure to like take on more tasks at home to kind of balance that out.
Wow.
Which of course, you know, it's the whole second shift things. It leads to a lot of people being extremely burnt out and tired out, you know, like dealing with both a high pressure job as well as like handling all these tasks at home. But I think that's interesting that it's like we can kind of self-sabotage in a way that on the outside looks good and more productive, but it's actually maybe destructive.
Fascinating.
It's funny when you were talking about working overtime or taking on more tasks, when you were saying that, it also made me think of when you're working freelance or something, of underbidding yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Of just being like, oh, sure, I'll do that thing for $100. And it ends up taking you 20 hours. And you're like, cool, I just made $5 an hour because I didn't feel like I deserved more than that.
Yeah. Right? I feel like actors do that all the time in Los Angeles. Like, yeah, I'll work for free. Like, I don't deserve to be paid for this thing because so many other people would go after it and do it for free as well. So,
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a huge one. That's a huge one. I think especially whenever you're in a position of having to price your own work or the value of your own work, whether it's like a tangible product that you put out or like you're a freelancer, you know, doing some kind of intangible work. That one's really, really hard. Because I think money itself is already so emotional, and then tying it also to like how much we feel like we deserve, how much do we feel like our time deserves or our labor deserves, like that just it can get really sticky really quick. And a lot of people can self-sabotage when they decide like, oh, I'm really not that worth that much. If I say it's gonna be this much, then it's gonna scare away the client. Like, already it's a client I don't deserve as it is, and so I'm just gonna underbid myself and you know, then be poor.
I could even see that applying on the other side with relationships too, instead of just the example of ending relationships as soon as they start to feel serious, because it's like, oh, that couldn't possibly work out for me, I better get out of this. But also maybe getting into relationships with people that don't feel that great to be with.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's like, afraid of being alone or.
Well, I was just going to say, because it's like, well, this is probably as good as I deserve.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So our second category here is control. And this one is basically the idea that I would rather be in control of things going badly than to feel like they're good, but it's out of my control that it could go bad at any moment. So the example here would be like you're consistently either creating problems or coming up with new problems or things to fight about in a relationship until you eventually break up. But at least you were sort of in control of all of that rather than being really happy and being, oh my gosh, this is great. And then if something does go wrong, if they do break up with you or something happens, that felt out of your control as opposed
it's
to
like
the other way.
A vulnerable position to be in.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like letting myself enjoy the good thing makes it that much scarier. So I'd rather be in control of it being bad than out of control of it being good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've anecdotally seen people do something where it's like, let's say they're in a monogamous relationship and one partner cheats. But what the downfall of the relationship is actually the person who cheated kind of accusing the other partner of something. And that's where it kind of all falls apart. Or I've also seen instances where it's like one person snoops their partner's phone, for instance. But what the actual downfall is that they, the person who snooped, actually kind of accusing the other person of like violating their privacy. And then it all kind of like spirals out of, you know, not really out of control, but, you know, kind of all spirals downward. And I guess it's that kind of same thinking of this idea of like, I kind of need to take control of the situation, even if it means flying the plane into the ground.
Right. Right.
Rather than myself being caught, or rather than all like the pressure and, you know, the spotlight being on me and what I've done wrong. Like, I've definitely seen that happen numerous times in people's relationships falling apart.
Yeah.
And I think this could also apply to, you know, just in your personal life, is like making irresponsible decisions or maybe even like doing shoddy work. But kind of doing something that's going to make sure that your business goes into the ground, or that you don't get those promotions, or that you get fired, or that you, you know, don't end up with a product that you're proud of. Because it's like, well, at least I was in control of that, as opposed to giving it my all. And then if it's still bad, that was out of my control. And that's a much worse outcome.
Yeah, it's like,
right?
Well, yeah, it's like, actually, your best work is like as much as you can give and as much as you are. And then if somebody kind of shits all over that or says that it's not good enough, then that's going to feel way worse than if you did kind of a shoddy job on something.
Right.
And they tell you, well, that wasn't very good. And you're like, in the back of your head, yeah, I know it wasn't, but at least, you know, I was in control of that situation. That's
right,
interesting.
Right. And I think that one's going to be related to
the next one.
Not the next one, but the one after that.
Yeah.
These two kind of get into each other. But yeah, you wanna keep going with the next one?
Sure. The middle one is going to be the old chestnut, imposter syndrome. Who, yeah.
For people who aren't familiar with imposter syndrome, how would you describe it?
For me, like, it's that idea that even if I get something really great in my life, I'm actually not worthy of it. Like, it's as though an imposter was coming in and is taking control of, like, the situation and saying, like, okay, you know, this imposter person got the thing that I am getting in this moment.
So you're saying you're the imposter.
Yeah, like, I'm
you
the
came
imposter.
In and pretended to be a successful person.
There you go. That's the one. I'm not actually a success. I'm just an imposter person. So, like yeah. For example, okay, I'm going to go back to acting, but
Can I jump in on this one?
Okay.
Because I feel like it is very closely related to self-worth in that sense.
Oh,
of feeling
for
like
sure.
You're not worthy of this. However, I know for me, where imposter syndrome comes up is more specifically in feeling like I'm not qualified for this, or like I've somehow deceived my way to this particular position of success, and I'm going to be found out. Like, I think that's a big part of imposter syndrome for me, is this idea of like,
if
people actually looked critically at me or critically at my work, they would find out that I'm not actually supposed to be here, that I am an imposter.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like one part self-worth and also one part feeling like there's some sort of weird deception.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I remember I did a national commercial a couple years ago, and like the entire time I was like, yeah, I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this. Mm-hmm. Like, someone much better than me should be doing this. Like, I'm going to get fired off of this job because, like, this is my first one and I'm not like worthy of being here, essentially. So yeah, it's exactly that thing. Like, I'm not a person who should be sitting in this position right now.
It's like the difference between category one, which was self-worth, is more like, I'm not going to do this thing, or I'm going to do it badly because I don't think I deserve it. And imposter syndrome is like,
I got the thing.
Somehow I got the thing. I better sabotage it because I don't deserve it.
Sure. Yeah. Right? Or even just like subconsciously telling yourself like, you are not worthy. Like, you are going to get it thrown off this job or whatever because I'm
but you
an
didn't
imposter.
Though like you didn't in
no,
that
I
example
know.
You didn't self-sabotage yourself, even if you did have that belief, which I think is something worth realizing as we talk in the second half about how to deal with these things. And it doesn't necessarily mean you won't ever have these freakouts or these fears.
No, absolutely.
But the importance of learning how to not self-sabotage yourself.
Yeah, I mean, so that's an example in my personal life, but also like in a relationship, you can meet a person and then they're really into you and you start dating them. But in the back of your mind, you're like, wait a minute, they're way more sexy than I am, way more intelligent than I am. Like, maybe they're more rich than I am, like more popular with all their friends, they're the life of the party. Like, why in the world would they be interested in me? There's no freaking reason why they would be.
So I'm going to create conflict or make it bad or like give them reasons to break up with me because obviously they couldn't. Like,
yeah, they couldn't possibly be interested in me. Yeah. Something like that. And this is an interesting one, is like, if you're at a networking event or a dating event or a social event, to kind of like downplay who you are in a sense, or just like talking down about yourself, that like that imposter syndrome in the back of your mind is like, well, nobody's going to be interested in me at this event. Like, I'm not worthy of people's time. So I'm just going to kind of like shit all over myself when
like
I'm
that,
talking to people.
Like that self-deprecating humor that can go
a little too far.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the next one, again, this is closely related to the control category, and all these things kind of build upon each other. We called this setting yourself up the bomb. But it's basically, it's like kind of planting the seeds of your own demise.
Wow, so epic.
I know, right? It's kind of under this assumption that it's like, well, if I don't try, then it's okay to fail. Or if I don't try, then like the sting of failure isn't quite as stingy. You know, and so it can be something like, you know, you don't study for a test because if you fail on the test, then you can just be like, oh, well, I didn't study. You know, clearly that's why. Instead of, oh, I tried my best and tried really hard and then failed. It's not on me. It's on the fact that, well, clearly I just didn't even try, you know. And so it kind of takes that pressure off, takes that sting out of the failure a little bit. In a relationship, it can be something like, you know, doing intentional things that you know are going to contribute toward the collapse of that relationship. You know, things like maybe you go stay out late drinking all the time and not communicate, or you flake out on your partner all the time, and it keeps you from being vulnerable and potentially getting hurt, because you can be like, well, yeah, whatever, like the relationship fell apart because I was just not around or just not present. You know, it's kind of, I feel like this is a little bit akin to trying to ghost your way out of a relationship. You know, it's kind of this idea of like, if I just like neglect things enough, then it's all going to fall apart, you know, especially if you feel like you don't feel confident enough or solid enough or maybe even brave enough to be the person to initiate that breakup conversation or to talk about the reasons or what you want to have change in the relationship. It's just easier to kind of go this route of setting yourself up the bomb, as it were.
And again, controlling the situation.
Yeah, definitely has some connections to that. Well, I feel like it's also it's like that idea of what is it? Basically that you could confuse it and think, oh no, I'm just being really honest with myself. And it's like, oh, this person broke up with me because I wasn't really around, or I wasn't communicative, or I was distant. Like, oh yeah, that's on me.
But it's like, why weren't you?
But that's the thing. It's like the reality is that you didn't do those things. You weren't those things, because then you could blame it on that instead of really giving it a go. And then if you fail, it's because they didn't like you, or at least that's how it feels. Right.
Sure.
Rather than saying, oh, I could blame it on a thing I did rather than on just me. So it's like, I think sometimes people can even trick themselves into thinking they're not doing this because they're like taking ownership of their own failures, when in reality they're not like taking ownership of things enough. And instead doing these things so they can blame it on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, the next one here is familiarity. This is basically kind of like the devil you know. And it's essentially the idea that I would rather have this thing that's not great, but I'm familiar and I at least know how to get by in this situation, than to venture off into something that could be better, but that I don't know.
That's uncharted, not familiar, waters.
Right?
Yeah.
So in life, this could look like something like staying at a job that you hate, or that you're really unhappy with, or that you really don't like the work environment, or anything like that. And there's a part of you that knows you could do something better, or that you could get something better, but that's just seems so overwhelming that it's like, well, I'll just stay at this thing because I at least understand it. In a relationship, this can look very similar, basically exactly the same, of staying in a relationship that's not very good. It's not happy. Maybe it's toxic. Maybe it's a little bit or a lot bit abusive, right? Any of those things, but it's familiar. You know it. You've kind of figured out how to get by with it. And so it's like, well, I'd rather do that than risk being alone because I don't know, or I don't know if anyone else would like me, right? So I'll stick with what's comfortable.
Yeah, or it feels safer because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then kind of a different spin on this is that maybe you have a fairly tumultuous relationship with a partner and that things have actually started to get better. Like, you have sort of worked out some of these things and you're starting to get along better, but that's not comfortable because it's not familiar. Ironically, the thing that's better like doesn't feel as comfortable. And so you'll do things to push their buttons or things to try to get more of that emotional, you know, fired up response. Yeah. And we talked about this a long time ago about long distance relationships, that it's something I found or I noticed that I was doing years and years and years ago during one of my first attempts at doing long distance, was over the phone, kind of starting like extra serious conversations or arguments or getting upset about stuff. I think because I missed the intense feelings that we had in NRE, and now that we were more long distance, it's like, well, I'm not feeling this intensity. I'm just kind of living my day-to-day life, so I've got to get that somehow. And so causing fights or getting upset about things was a way to do that.
Yeah, well. So the next category is going to be disempowerment. This is a really interesting one, and it's kind of this idea that like you don't start a task or a project because you don't feel empowered to be able to like take action. You don't feel maybe educated enough to like know how to even start something, and so you just like avoid it altogether. So in life, like you might want to create something, you might want to even like create your own podcast or write a book or like start a YouTube channel or, you know, write a play or something along those lines. But you don't have any idea what the first step to take is. You don't know like how to market it, how to get it out there. So you just choose to scrap the project altogether, or you procrastinate or do something along those lines and then just like never get it off the ground. And in a relationship, it can be just perpetually like avoiding a difficult talk or something that really needs to be addressed because, again, you don't know where to begin with that, or you know, like, hey, this is going to be really tough for both of us, and so I'd rather like stay in the familiar pattern of like just the day to day, even if it's not going very well, and so I'm doing that as opposed to like really having like the honest conversation with my partner.
In the book The War of Art, have either of you read that book?
I've only read it by extension of you telling me.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I was like, you've talked about it over the years.
Yeah. Anyway, The War of Art, it's a really interesting book about kind of getting past self-sabotage, specifically as an artist and, you know, writing or making music or whatever it is. But one of the things I remember from that book that's related to this category specifically is the idea that, you know, like no composer says like, I don't ever want to write a good piece of music, or I'm never going to make that. I'm just not going to do it. It's everyone's going to do it tomorrow. Mm. It's that idea of like, I will write the next great symphony or the next great novel, but tomorrow, because I don't really know how to start it, but maybe tomorrow I will.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I like, I'll be honest, I really like the narrative of like taking, because it's so easy to shit on procrastination. It's like simultaneously so easy to just like shit on it, like, oh, it's terrible, and oh, it's the worst, and like such a bad habit, but then also to like really relate to everyone, because it's like almost everyone procrastinates.
At some point, yeah.
You're right, but I really like the idea of kind of changing the narrative around procrastination, that it is about this. It's about like not feeling empowered or knowledgeable enough to even start a task, that it's not necessarily inherent, like, you know, related to like, oh, you're self-sabotaging because you're so freaking lazy. You know, that it's like maybe you're self-sabotaging because you just don't know, or you just don't even know how to break up the task into different steps, or how to break it into smaller tasks or whatever, things like that. That is closely related to the next category, which is something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is perfectionism. So it's this idea of like you self-sabotage because everything needs to be perfect before you can actually take action. And because you're waiting until everything's absolutely perfect, you don't actually end up taking action.
Mm. No, this just reminds me of this woman who was a really, really famous, really glorious figure skater, Sasha Cohen, like in the early 2000s to like 2006. And she called herself a perfectionist. And she would like, she never could do like a clean long program. Like she always would at least like make one mistake or something within it. And I think it was just kind of a mental block about it, but she always blamed it on like perfectionism. Like, I just want to be so perfect, so that's like causing me to not be able to ever be perfect. It's interesting. And like, I know how you have talked about, well, it's challenging sometimes because you want like your book or your whatever, like to be perfect. And so It's hard to like get started with it or complete something or not have a mental block about it.
Totally. So you know, in life it can manifest as, you know, maybe you do create something like a podcast or a book or a video or a piece of art or something like that, but like you never show it to anyone or you never publish it or you never submit it because it's imperfect.
Hey, you guys, I know, remember that whole podcast that we recorded like 2 years ago that we never released?
No. Oh, yes. You mean about figure skating?
Yes, I remember it.
Yep.
I remember it.
Yep.
Yes.
We did that a couple times.
Yep. Yeah, we recorded some whole like, multiple episodes of a podcast that were like, nope.
Nope, it's not perfect enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's in the Multigamery vault.
Yeah.
There's so much content that has been released because we're just like, nope, not perfect enough. I know for me, it always comes up in my writing. Like I definitely have the terrible habit that everyone says writers shouldn't do, but that I do all the time, which is like editing while I write.
Yeah.
Of being like, I'll write a line. I'm like, no, wait, it'll be better this way. No, wait, it should be this way. Oh, wait, no, that's not the right word. Oh, what word do I want? And like, while I've been poring over getting this one sentence perfect, everyone else has written 200 sentences. And so that kind of holds me back from like creating more content. In a relationship, kind of similar to the disempowerment thing, it can be avoiding a difficult talk or some kind of uncomfortable communication just perpetually because you're hung up on getting your words or your thoughts like 100% right or 100% clear. I think it's not a coincidence that I'm both a perfectionist and a chewer instead of a spewer when it comes to processing things, because I'm all about like, okay, I need to sit and like chew on this and like get 100% clear on what I'm going to say so that I can deliver this perfect monologue to my partner and then I can talk about it. But I can't talk about it in the moment, or I can't talk about it while I'm feeling things, or I can't talk about it while my thoughts are in a jumble, because, you know, that's just not going to do. And so then the talk ends up getting pushed off and pushed back and procrastinated on, and then maybe even never happens. I've definitely seen it with clients who avoid the next step in opening up their relationship because they're waiting for it to be 100% comfortable or to feel 100% perfect, which very rarely happens whenever you're dealing with personal growth or with something new, is that it rarely feels 100% perfect or comfortable. But because they're waiting for that, they end up not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so like the difference between these last two categories, the disempowerment one and the perfectionism one, is that like for opening up a relationship, the disempowerment one would be like, this is something that I really want, but I don't know how someone would possibly talk to their partner about that or how people would even do that, so like I don't do it. And then the perfectionism one is the, I've read every single book ever published on polyamory and I've listened to every episode of Multiamory twice. But like, I haven't...
My partner and I have spent 60 hours talking about it.
Yes. Right, but we haven't quite evaluated like every possible contingency plan for everything that could happen. And so we haven't moved forward. So that's kind of like, they can seem very similar when you describe them at first of like, oh, well, you just don't know what to do, so you don't move forward. But like the way they manifest is where they're very different from each other.
We've seen this in both cases.
Yeah.
People...
Yes, yeah.
Deciding to go into polyamory or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the time.
And then our last category here in this half is about community identity. So what this looks like is, say you have a group of friends, and what your friends do when they're together is you all get together and you complain about your terrible relationships, or you complain about the shitty dates that you go on, or whatever it is. That in this case, say you then go on a date that's actually good, and you're starting to have a relationship that's really good, there can be this tendency to want to self-sabotage that, either by just getting out of that relationship or causing problems in it, or like looking for more things to be upset about. Because if I were to be happy in my relationship, how do I fit in with my friend group anymore? Because this is what we do. This is how we bond socially, right? Or another example would be, say you have opened up your relationship and you and your partner both have been struggling to find dates, and then you do find one, it can feel like, oh, that's going to make me disconnected from my partner, or that's going to upset them. So I won't go on this date, or I'll find some reason why this person's not right for me, or something like that, to try to sabotage it in order to maintain comfort in that relationship. And the irony here is that in both of those cases, your friends didn't even necessarily say, you can't talk to us anymore if you're happy. And your partner didn't say, I don't want you to find a date. But this is something that you've put on yourself of like, well, I don't want to be different from my community. So I'm going to ensure that I don't become different from them by having more success.
Yeah.
I feel like this is kind of, it's kind of related to the familiarity category that we talked about earlier, but I feel like there's a part of it is about like maintaining status quo to a certain extent, that sometimes we will self-sabotage in order to maintain status quo.
Yeah.
I think
this one's just kind of focused on like how you fit into a community of some sort, even if that's just your community with your partner, whereas the other one's almost more like just yourself,
right?
Yeah. Of just what you're used to, I guess.
I mean, a lot of these are just like kind of a question of like, where do I feel safest, I guess, as well. And if that is like within this community that has remained the same for years and years, and I don't want to like leave that because that feels unsafe, or a variety of other things, you know, the disempowerment, even, you know, deciding like, well, it feels safest to stay in this place, and it's unsafe to like possibly create a new thing and then not know like where that's going to take me in my life. So
definitely.
Yeah.
And then this one, when we were preparing this, Dedeker pointed out that this comes up a lot with someone who is monogamous and wants to be non-monogamous, but worries, well, I'll lose all my friends, right? I won't be able to fit in with my friend group. So I'm going to make sure that I'm not able to become non-monogamous, or even the other way around of like, I'm non-monogamous and I kind of actually want to have a monogamous relationship, but I'm worried that then I won't fit in with my, you know, polyamory discussion group friends and things like that. So yeah, this can definitely come up in a lot of different ways. In terms of that, wanting to be part of a community, not wanting to disrupt the status quo of that community and your place in it.
Exactly.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love adamandeve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
So now in the second half of the episode, we're going to look at some things you can do to actually address these. How do you stop doing these kinds of self-sabotage, both in terms of looking inside yourself and figuring out kind of what are the underlying causes of this? How can I change those beliefs? And then also some just sort of practical, like, how can I just stop doing the things, even if I still have some of those beliefs? And I really wanted to title this whole second half, "If You Got a Problem, Yo, I'll Solve It."
What is this?
Actually,
from?
You have to solve it yourself. Vanilla Ice.
Oh.
My whole thing is
you
like,
are just really bringing out the references.
Well,
today.
He's bringing out how old he is.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
I had a question. Okay, so if this section is kind of like, you know, combating self-sabotage, so we're looking for what's the opposite of self-sabotage? What's the opposite of sabotage? Collaboration? Support?
Stop. Collaborate and listen. Damn it. Okay, yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah, so if you got a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Stop, collaborate, and listen. That's the answer.
There you go.
How you do it.
Is that the answer? I don't think that answered my question.
No, it doesn't.
I have a feeling that's the best I'm going to get out of the two of you.
Yeah,
so I guess
think
I'll quit while I'm ahead.
It might be.
Self-sabotage.
Reflection?
Self empowerment, self
sure
progress.
Yeah, empowerment's part of that. Progress is part of that.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of those things. But the first one is self-examination, which I think is probably the initial one to even like move forward past self-sabotage, but probably the most difficult to get to initially. Because if you see that like your life is continuing to go in this kind of cyclical pattern-based way, it might be time to examine things about yourself.
Like if that first half of the episode resonated with you.
Yeah, and you're like, yikes. Oh man, here we go.
Yeah.
Then maybe it's time to take a look at yourself. So the first thing that you might want to do is look at the things that you believe about yourself because other people told you. So like that can include messages from your parents, from teachers you had in the past, from your exes. All three of those resonate for me right off the bat. Yeah. I mean, definitely like, I've had teachers who said that I wasn't good enough at X, Y, or Z thing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, whatever. Parent things, exes, absolutely. All of those. It's important to actually like look at yourself and look at the difference between, did somebody tell me this because it's true, or do I have this belief about myself just because it was said to me at one point in my life? And is that actually truly the case? And is it like serving me in this moment?
Yeah. When I was first going to therapy, I forget what I was even talking to my therapist about, but like I mentioned something where it was like, yeah, well, like I can't do this because then if I do this, then like, you know, then that's going to just like feel rude and it's going to be inappropriate. So I can't say that. And my therapist just said, oh, who taught you that?
Ooh.
and you were like, ugh. And I was like, oh, damn.
damn.
But I really appreciated that question, just framing it that way of like, oh, who told you that? Oh, who taught you that? When you say something about yourself, especially when you say something about yourself that's negative, it just invites that examination of like, really though, who did teach me that? It's like, oh, maybe my parents taught me that, maybe in an indirect way. Maybe they didn't directly say to me like, oh, you're rude and inappropriate, but indirectly I got that message that I am a rude and inappropriate person.
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel like this comes up a lot with things like clumsiness, where it's if you just got told over and over that you were clumsy, that can be one that you sort of
manifest,
can take on as a belief about yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Or I think in my case, some of my perfectionism comes from I did really, really well in school. And so being told over and over again, like, oh, like you do so well in school, or you always get straight A's, or you're always so good at X, Y, and Z, that then it's like, well, I can never not be good at X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Essentially, that can happen.
That's a really good example. Yeah.
Yeah. There's the old adage floating around that it's like the ways that parents speak to their children end up becoming their inner voice when they become adults. And I think that applies for both criticism and even praise as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like these are the things that are valuable about me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, jeez. Absolutely. Well, and to go along with that, there's also things that our parents believed about themselves that we adopted, that we took on. And even like if a parent is not really present in our lives, like for instance, if our parents were like missionaries and they are constantly going off and, you know, leaving us at home or whatever, then we see that as like something that's important and maybe view ourselves as like the less important thing, as this thing outside of ourselves as more important. And we take that on. We adopt that belief to a degree. Or just like, hey, you know, I don't know, your parents are scared of X, Y, or Z thing. And so therefore you take on that thing as well and are always afraid of money or afraid of, I don't know.
Money's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Money's a huge one. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I know my mom was like, definitely it just had a lot of like money things throughout her life that she not necessarily was needed to worry about, but it was instilled in her that she should be worried about it or uptight about money. And I definitely think that I've taken that on in my life to a degree.
I'm laughing because I just put some things together. So I think I inherited my mom's self-criticism about her looks because growing up, I didn't get any like direct criticism from people close to me about my looks. I know some people do, but I definitely didn't get that. I got all the normal messages that like girls get about how they're supposed to look, but at least from my mom and from my close inner circle, like I never got criticism about my looks. But I still inherited the ways that my mom criticized herself about her looks, which was like, and my mom is like a beautiful woman and like has always like aged incredibly well, you know? Well, but that's the thing. But like I grew up listening to her criticize her own weight to herself all the time. Or, you know, if she left the house without makeup on, always commenting on like, oh, I look like a hag right now. Or honestly needing to leave the house with her bangs perfectly.
Oh, it all makes sense.
And there it all is. Mom would finally be ready to leave the house. And if it was the summertime and like the air conditioning was going, she would make one of us go over to switch off the air conditioning because she couldn't walk in front of it because it would mess up her bangs.
Wow.
And
oh boy.
That's 100% me now.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. It all makes sense, y'all.
There it is.
I feel like you've gotten better about letting it go, but the
bangs. Well, my bangs have got, well, I got a better haircut that where my bangs behave better. That's why.
Yeah. Thank you. Hashtag thank you, Josh. Yeah.
Oh my God. I did not expect you were going to get into my bangs hang up today on this episode.
That's okay. That is what it is. Well, and yes, it is important to examine also these defense mechanisms that we have created to combat all of these beliefs about ourselves.
Well, to combat also like the behavior of the people in our lives.
Sure.
So like your example earlier, Emily, about the like parents who are gone a lot of the time, that perhaps that's upsetting for a kid. And so that kid then develops some beliefs or some behaviors of their own to make that not hurt so bad. Perhaps being aloof or perhaps, you know, being
ghosting someone.
Yeah, or like, you know, ghosting their parents or being
avoidantly attached.
Right, yeah. being angsty or whatever. And that at the time was very helpful, right? Mm-hmm. It helped them at that time to not be so hurt by the situation. But then later in life, it becomes a problem where it gets in the way of them actually connecting with people. It causes them to self-sabotage instead of actually having relationships with people who will be there for them and who are reliable.
Yeah.
So the three categories, the first one is things that people told you about yourself that you have believed. The second one is things that you watched other people, usually your parents, believe about themselves that then you said, oh, that must be true of me too. And then the third is kind of what have you built up to protect yourself from some of these behaviors you were exposed to over and over again that might not be serving you today.
Yeah.
So then the first answer here is to get some outside help. And this could mean therapy, it could mean counseling, it could mean a support group, especially if we're talking about handling, you know, addiction or addictive behaviors or things like that. Getting that outside help can be really helpful to get you to kind of a baseline from which you can then work on improving things. And this could also, depending on your situation, it could be even something as simple as just getting an accountability buddy. I think we've mentioned before on this show that for things like that, it's generally best not to have that be your romantic partner. This is something that a piece of advice I heard years ago that when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. It's basically like you don't want your partner to be both the person that you're supposed to like love and feel happy with and have sex with, but then they're also kind of like your jailer or the policeman or like the trainer keeping you accountable, that like the one relationship doesn't really foster the other. I mean, and like, you know, in a day-to-day situation, obviously, if you want to do some role playing of that, that can work, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. And so, I mean, getting the outside help, again, it doesn't have to be like shelling out a ton of money for a therapist. It could be like, if you examine like, oh, I noticed that I have major imposter syndrome going on as like whenever I sit down to work on this particular project. And so I'm going to find a friend that I trust when I feel that imposter syndrome and just talk to them about it, you know, just be like, hey, oh my God, the imposter syndrome is coming up. Like, can you just tell me that like, I'm good at what I do and it's going to be okay, you know? And it couldn't be just as simple as that. Like your friend can be your accountability buddy in that sense. And ideally, like maybe that's a mutual thing as well, that you kind of help encourage your friend through the way, you know, through them kind of getting over the ways that they often self-sabotage as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it could also be like finding, you know, a social worker or a coach or something who does a sliding scale to make mm-hmm. it affordable for you. There's lots of different ways that you could get this. So don't feel like, oh, well, that's not an option I could do. Maybe if you are having that thought, examine which of the self-sabotaging things that might be coming from.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's a huge one.
Yeah.
No, that makes so much sense. I mean, because I've done it, like when it comes to getting professional help, that I've gone through all those different varieties of either like, no, like that's not something I can afford, or like, no, like there's other people who are way more messed up than I am who actually need help. I don't actually need help for these tiny little things, or no, it just feels more comfortable to not break up my routine. You know, like
I've definitely done the thing of like spending a ton of time looking on Yelp or trying to find sites of like researching different people and then never going to any of them because I'm too overwhelmed by the whole process. Yeah.
Or because you're like trying to find the perfect one.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've definitely done that too.
Yeah.
Wow.
It doesn't exist.
Coming together, y'all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So another thing that can help break you out of self-sabotage cycles is learning to reframe failure. This is such a huge one. We could probably do an entire episode just on the topic of reframing failure.
I like that.
But for instance,
we should do that. Yeah.
Okay. Put it on the list.
Okay.
But for instance, you know, many of us carry the story that, you know, quote unquote, serious talks in relationships means that there's some kind of failure. You know, I think a lot of us carry this message of like, love's supposed to be organic, and to a certain extent, it's supposed to be easy. And like, if you're truly connected to someone, you know, you're always able to finish each other's sentences. And so that means if we have to sit down and like schedule a talk or talk about something uncomfortable, that means there's some kind of failure. And that failure or that fear of the discomfort can cause people to just avoid it perpetually, never bring up the topic until it explodes later on or causes much bigger issues. So I'm often directing people, especially clients, to reframe this idea around communication to realize that like intentional and uncomfortable communication, it's not a failure. It's something that helps your relationships get better. You know, it's an opportunity that helps develop more intimacy and closeness between you and the person that you're communicating with.
Yeah.
It's almost like exercising to get stronger or to get in shape. And that I
that
feel
is
like
uncomfortable it can be at times,
right? It's
especially if you're just starting out.
Exactly. But I think most of us, at least on an intellectual level, understand that that's something you need to do in order to get stronger or to get in shape. But it's like we apply the thinking of relationships would be like if you thought, oh, well, I should just be strong. Like I should just be in shape. And if I have to work out, that means something's wrong with me or I'm failing. So like that can't be it.
Yeah.
Right.
Like or if the workout is challenging.
Right. If the workout's hard, that means something must be wrong, which is exactly the opposite of what you need to do if you actually want to get any progress with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Related, there's also this story that we carry culturally that any relationship ending is a failure. And therefore, a lot of people will self-sabotage by stubbornly staying in a relationship that's not making anybody happy because we're trying to avoid that sting of failure that, you know, and how a relationship ending is going to reflect on us. And again, it's learning to reframe that story that like a relationship ending or de-escalating or changing in some way, you know, it just allows both people to keep moving forward in a better direction for their lives. That's not necessarily a failure. Outside of the realm of relationships, when it comes to things like creating something like writing or art or creating a new project, I know for me, I'm really trying so hard to just remind myself that it's like part of the process is failure in both big and small, you know, and it's like failure and imperfection, and it's okay to trust that process. You know, like it's okay to just make something even if it's not perfect. It's okay to make something even if it doesn't 100% capture what you were going for. That it's like the process of making something or taking that step forward is still progress, essentially. And that's, I mean, I don't know, that's a huge one, but it's definitely one that like, if I keep reminding myself of that, that it's like, it's okay for it to be uncomfortable and imperfect, you know, that's going to still move you forward. That's definitely helped me to kind of become braver and not just like sabotage myself by constantly just choosing to not create or avoiding creating or writing or things like that.
Yeah.
And then the next one we have here is choose your friends wisely. So we all have heard this before with, you know, kids in school. It's like, oh, well, you know, he fell in with the wrong crowd or right or the right crowd, and that makes a difference and that our parents will worry about who we're associating with in school. The same is true for you today. This isn't just something that applies to kids. And this is something that if you like look this up, like look up, do a Google search for something like, how does your friend group affect your success? Or how does your friend group affect your decisions? Or how does your friend group affect your health? Any number of these, there are so many buttloads of studies showing how true this is, that in things from self-control to students' performance in school to workers' both job satisfaction and their performance at their job, your health, just so many things can be determined by looking at your group of friends. And you can basically look at essentially the average of your group of friends and determine how you're going to be in a certain category.
Interesting.
And I think it can feel really mercenary or harsh to people to just say like, oh, so what? You're saying I should just stop being friends with all my friends? And yeah, maybe it's not quite that simple, but it is really something worth thinking about, because we talked before about the need to fit into a social group can actually stop you from improving beyond that, because then you'll feel like you're not part of that social group. Whereas similarly, a social group who is doing well in these certain areas will more likely encourage you and support you in being more successful in those areas, whether it's relationships or work or, you know, other parts of your personal life, because that's how you fit in better with your community.
Yeah. I'll save it for the bonus episode.
Okay.
What I was going to say.
Okay. All right. Well, for our patrons, you'll check that out later. For our patrons,
you
get it.
If you want to hear, become a patron.
Gosh, what a tease.
I know, right? the last one that we have is just do it Jessica Graham style. If you remember our dear friend Jessica Graham from many moons ago when we did the episode, an interview about her book, Good Sex. She talked about cold turkey, doing things cold turkey, like
actually
stopping.
She didn't talk about this on that episode, I don't think.
Okay.
This is just a different thing she's taught me and Dedeker that we like to bring up from time to time. I don't think this actually came up on that episode.
I think she included this in her book, though.
Oh, yeah.
I think she did.
Okay.
Cool, this cool.
She talked
book.
About it in the book. Okay. But it was when she was talking about like a self-sabotaging behavior, which was smoking cigarettes. And it was just like quitting it cold turkey, like just don't put the cigarette in your mouth. And I was laughing because I was like, that's what I did when I became vegan. I just didn't put the turkey in my mouth. It was cold turkey. I just didn't put it in my mouth. Yeah. No, but really, I mean, it is that just taking that leap. If something is scary to you, just do it anyways. If something is not going well, then stop doing it. And that's tough. That's a tough one. That's really something that's like, oh man, can I actually do that? That takes a lot of courage, I think.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I mean, it sounds so simplistic, but I do think the point that Jessica always makes whenever she talks about this is it's like some people just need that permission.
Yeah.
You know, like that they don't need to dive deep into therapy about something, that it is literally like, okay, it is okay to just stop. It's like something that Jason and I say back and forth to each other all the time. I believe it was Ajahn Chah, who is a Thai like Buddhist monk who's written a bunch of stuff, a bunch of books, really venerated in his field. And I read this story about he had a translator. It was this American guy who was translating Thai into English and like translating English into Thai for an audience that was giving Ajahn Chah questions. And someone in the audience had described like, you know, often I have feelings of guilt that come up like from the past or recent past or whatever. And sometimes that comes up in meditation. And I was wondering, you know, what Ajahn Chah's thoughts were on like handling guilt within a meditative practice. And the translator realized that in the Thai language, there isn't really a word for guilt. And he was like, huh, oh gosh, okay. So he kind of had to essentially cobbled together this explanation of what guilt was in Thai, because there wasn't actually a word for it. And Ajahn Chah was like, wait, what? Like, wait, what is it? Like, wait, what? And so the translator kept like struggling and like trying to describe what guilt was. And then finally, Ajahn Chah said, you know what? That sounds like suffering. Just tell them they shouldn't do that. And so that's something that, like, Jason and I have adopted in saying to each other, like, sometimes when I'm like, I don't know. Like, I want to put together a book proposal, but then I start thinking about this, and then I'm like, but maybe the book shouldn't be about this, but then I'm like, oh, but then I'm writing it, and then, like, Jace is just like, it sounds like suffering, just don't do that.
That's good.
Yeah, we've gotten each other with that one many times.
And sometimes even something that simple actually is really helpful to be like, oh, you know what, you're right, it's just suffering, it's just self-sabotage, I'm going to do something else that's not that.
Wow, wise words. Yeah. Wise words, madam and sir. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we definitely want to hear about all of the ways in which you self-sabotage and the ways in which you choose to stop suffering and stop doing that. I think that would be really interesting to hear, because I know this is a very personal thing. I think it's something that, like, pretty much everyone has to deal with at some point in their lives or another. And it's great to hear, like, how one combats that. And we hope that some of these ways are ways that you yourself can learn to combat self-sabotaging and make your life better, make your life happier. So the best place to share your thoughts with other listeners is on this episode's discussion thread and our private Facebook or Discourse forums. You can get access to these groups and join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can email us at info@multiamory.com. Leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05. Or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. Multiamory is created and produced by Jace Lindgren, Dedeker Winston, and me, Emily Matlack. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balbanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.